Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. This week there was an explosion at an oil rig near Douglas. Natural gas spewed from the well and about 50 people were evacuated from their homes. My colleague Willow Belden visited Douglas shortly after the incident and put together this montage of residents' reactions.
My name's Ralph. I live here in Douglas, Wyoming. I've worked for 40 years out there in the gas fields. I have no problem with this. It happens. I think they did everything there is to be done right. They brought in the best bunch to fix it. I don't see any problems.
Teresa Wolf, I live on Seven Bridger Trail, so it's right out by me. I'm all right. I'm sure they've got it under control and stuff like that, so I guess there's a little bit of danger there where you're working and you're around gas and oil and all that kind of stuff. I see that they're out there monitoring the air and stuff like that, so I guess I'm okay with it. I hope there's no danger that comes from it, but I'm all for drilling.
Donna McMichael and I just live in the middle of town on South 8th Street. I hope they figure out what happened and get it taken care of so it doesn't happen again. I think it could affect animals and it could affect the people, and if they don't get it under control, environmental problems.
Sean Johnson, I've been living here for 23 years now. I work in the drilling industry, and unfortunately, bad things do happen in the drilling industry, but we take all the preventative measures we can to avoid such catastrophes. I don't have any concerns with health risks, water. I mean, everything we do is pretty preventative like that. Usually, if there's any kind of sort of release, it's more of a health hazard to the people right there.
Christy Mogan, and we live out in the subdivision that's affected by the rig. You know, this is really displacing a lot of people. And we didn't even understand what had happened because we weren't there. I was in a class, and I came back, and you could feel the air change. You could feel the static there was a different feeling in the air. You could smell solvents in the beginning and then gases. I didn't know to evacuate until the next morning when I woke up, and I wasn't feeling well. And I couldn't milk my cows because the gas was so thick. I couldn't go out and do my morning chores. So we had to leave. We were staying at a ranch with some friends. They were very nice and said, you can use our bunkhouse. We had to move our cows because you have to milk your cow every day or they dry out. So we had to move our cows. We had to move all of our animals. My kids both have had bloody noses in the last 2 days where it's not normal. You know, I feel fine today. But that morning, talking on the phone, all my friends were like, are you okay? Your voice is really bad. And I don't know if the numbness in my fingers was just lack of sleep because of the noise that came out of that flume. It sounded like an airplane was going to land in our house. It was horrendous, you know? But we're all together. We're all alive. We've got all of our animals. It could be worse.
We are now joined by U.S. Senator John Barrasso. Recently, Senator Barrasso has been very critical of the Obama administration because of its position on such things as new air standards as it applies to the coal industry and a number of other EPA-led provisions that he says will just kill jobs. Senator Barrasso joins us today from the cloakroom just outside of the U.S. Senate. Senator, to start with, why do you hate the environment?
You know, everybody in Wyoming loves the environment, loves our state, and we have a great tradition, Bob, 121 years of statehood by multiple use of the land, using our incredible resources, a lot of which are energy resources, also the land for grazing, hunting, recreation, still the most beautiful place in the world, and I think that the most responsible stewards of the land are the people of Wyoming who live right there.
I guess when I read some of your comments and listen to you, I'm wondering what you see specifically that would cost jobs, because I haven't seen that connection.
Well, the rules and regulations that continue to come out of EPA, and specifically things that deal with the really go way beyond the original intent of the law, have real costs to those who are creating jobs, and the benefits, I think, are limited or theoretical, and we don't know exactly what they're going to be, but the costs are huge. A lot of it depends is related to Wyoming's coal. I was in Newcastle last weekend, Gillette a couple weeks before that. People are very concerned that the EP regulations are going to impact on Wyoming's ability to sell and ship coal. And as the EPA regulations are shutting down coal-fired power plants around the country, that's impacting people who have those jobs. And those are good jobs with good benefits, insurance, retirement. And a lot of those folks want their kids someday to grow up and have those jobs. So, you know, right now we're blessed in Wyoming. We have a robust economy. The unemployment rate is under 6%, you know, in the 5.45 range compared to the national numbers of over 8%. Wyoming has recently been listed as the best-run state in the country, and that's why I like to let the people of Wyoming make those decisions, not Washington.
Any chance, though, that the low sulfur coal, we would be able to take advantage of these new EPA regulations?
Well, you know, Wyoming has clean coal because of our low sulfur coal. But when the administration goes against the what's coming out of coal-fired power plants and they're closing across the country, that makes it harder to sell any coal and use any coal. And, you know, right now we want to make energy as clean as we can, as fast as we can, without raising costs for American consumers. And coal is the most available, affordable, reliable, and secure source of energy. We have all the sources of energy in Wyoming. We have incredible renewable energy with the wind. We have incredible abilities, I believe, to be more efficient in how we use energy as a society. But we have all the red, white, and blue energy, the oil, the gas, the coal, the uranium for nuclear power, and I want to make sure that we continue to use those.
Senator John Barrasso visiting with us. Senator, another question along those same lines is about renewable energy. We've been hearing a lot of our debate surrounding oil and gas and that sort of thing. Where are we with some of the tax incentives for wind energy and that sort of thing?
Yeah, one of the issues that happens in Washington is they approve something for a year and then it goes off and they don't approve it. And the wind issue has been, there have been incentives one year and then not another year. And Bob, this goes back to long before I even started in the Wyoming State Senate, when you and I would talk there off the Senate floor in Cheyenne. You know, it's not any way to have a long-term energy plan. We need a long-term energy plan. And find a way to use all of our resources in the way that you and I know and the people of Wyoming know they need to be used. When the president you know, says we need all of the above, I think that we need all of the above and not, as he had said under his plan, the electricity rates would necessarily skyrocket. The technology is going to continue to be developed long term, but for right now, I've introduced a bill, bipartisan, try to work with people on both sides of the aisle. Senator Manchin from West Virginia, who was as a governor, was at the time was a governor with Dave Friedenthal. They work closely because we're both from coal states. He and I have introduced, along with others, the American Alternative Fuels Act. So all of those things are ways that I think that we can use a broader brush to more energy sources.
You and Senator Hatch have some legislation. Could you just briefly share what's that about?
Yes. We just introduced it's called the West Act. I'm the chair of the Senate Western Caucus, and we have come out with an entire agenda to break down Washington's barriers to America's red, white, and blue jobs. And Senator Hatch, as part of that Western Caucus, he is the chairman of our subcommittee on public lands, and this is a group of about 10 different key pieces of legislation that the House has already passed. These are going to be bills that will generate quality jobs, increase energy production, and they passed the House, and they've been blocked in the Senate by Harry Reid, and we're just trying to get that whole package of bills up for a vote and to the president, because we need to get America back to work.
Senator John Barrasso visiting with us. Senator, another thing that certainly creates jobs is highway money. And as we all know, that bill has been hung up in the House, and it just seems like we can't get a good transportation bill out of there. What is the prognosis for that? You're a doctor. Make a prognosis on where that goes.
Right now, the bill is a highway bill has passed the Senate. There's a separate one in the House, and the difference is the House bill includes in it the Keystone XL pipeline, the pipeline to bring oil from our northern neighbor Canada into the United States. Instead of having to rely so much on Saudi Arabia. I mean, it just makes sense that we would want that oil into the United States. The president has blocked the pipeline being built because as president, he gets to say what crosses the border into the United States. And one of the inclusions in the highway bill that's through the House is a component that deals specifically with that Keystone XL pipeline. It's not government money. They're talking about thousands and thousands of new jobs immediately in the production and construction of the pipeline, and yet the president has kind of dug in his heels on it, Bob, and said, no, I don't want it. Now, we tried to get it through in the Senate, and we picked up it might have been a dozen Democrats who voted in a bipartisan way in favor of the Keystone XL pipeline. Right now, that's one of the sticking points on the highway bill, but I think there's general agreement that we need a highway bill.
It would make sense that you drop that and maybe fight that one another day, wouldn't it?
It does, to me, point to the president's obstruction of American energy jobs and red, white, and blue jobs, especially since this is, oil, it's a product that we need. At gas prices going up, and I think I paid $3.46 in Casper last weekend. You know, Americans are feeling the pain at the pump when it costs $100 to fill up the pickup truck. They know that this is energy that we need. The president shouldn't be blocking it.
Senator Brasso, last thing I would like to ask you about, we were talking about the Wolf legislation that Wyoming has finally gotten through. Governor Mead had mentioned to those of us in the media that he'd been talking with the delegation. Is there a chance that we could get legislation that Montana and Idaho got where people cannot sue on that issue?
That's exactly what we're working on, and the governor has been a champion on that. My position from the days working on this in the Wyoming legislature are that the wolf ought to be under the control of Wyoming, not Washington, and that the wolf has been devastating to our livestock and wildlife, and we need to get the kind of legislation that they have in those other states.
Does that sound like that could happen?
There are Democrats that continue to try to block that in the Senate. We're trying to get it attached to legislation that we can get passed.
Senator John Barrasso, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
When we come back, we'll look at how gas prices could affect tourism in Wyoming this summer, and we'll hear about a new exhibit focusing on scientific research that was done at the Territorial Prison in Laramie. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. Analysts are making conflicting predictions about where gas prices will go this summer. Some are forecasting record highs, while others say prices at the pump have already peaked. Businesses in Wyoming's service industry hope for the latter, as they depend on an injection of tourism dollars each summer. Wyoming Public Radio's Rebecca Martinez spoke with several businesses near Yellowstone about what might happen if gas prices climb with the temperature.
Every summer, a healthy stream of tourists passes through Cody into Yellowstone National Park. They stop to eat, shop, and pay homage to Buffalo Bill on their way into the wilderness. Scott Balio, who directs the Cody Chamber of Commerce, says this year should be no different.
As I talk to our members, we're seeing good bookings in the hotels, good bookings in the park.
But it's still early in the travel year. Recent projections of high gas prices have caused a stir in the travel industry. For the last 7 years, gas prices have climbed an average of 93 cents per gallon from the start of the year to the peak of prices, usually around Memorial Day. That's according to the petroleum analysts at GasBuddy.com. If their predictions come true, the national average could reach $4.20 per gallon this summer, even $5 in some parts of the country. Though some motorists might find these costs prohibitive, Ballew isn't worried. Yellowstone is still an incredibly popular destination, and most people coming from far away have already booked flights and rooms in advance.
As people look at their spending, vacations are one of the last things that they're willing to cut. And a lot of that is an emotional, maybe an emotional response, the fact that it's time with family. People really value it.
Tara Jones of AAA Mountain West says it's premature to worry about record high gas prices, since so many things could affect the crude oil market before Memorial Day. But current trends show that gas is cheaper this year than last, and prices at the pump have actually been declining in recent weeks. Still, Jones says anything can happen.
Motorists will consider the price of gas in their budgeting and their expenses, and if they have to cut down on other expenses like food and entertainment, they will do that in order to still make their trip.
So it sounds like hotels are pretty safe, but what about retail? Wes Allen owns Sunlight Sports, an outdoor equipment shop in Cody. He says good summer business from tourists means Cody residents make more money and thus circulate more of it around town during the off-season. He says record high gas prices would be a cause for concern.
Let's say that you're walking up and down Main Street and maybe you want a new water bottle because you're really thirsty riding around in your car because it's 105 degrees outside. That water bottle may be $15. If you just spent $30 more than maybe you should have on a tank of gas, that'll make your $15 purchase a lot less attractive. And probably, you know, there's a chance that you won't buy it.
Even so, Allen says Sunlight Sports is still pretty safe since they offer advice and equipment for outdoor adventurers bound for Yellowstone. He says he'd be worried if he owned a restaurant, since the gas pump pinch would mean less money for customers to spend on desserts and drinks. Jessica Coburn, who manages the Wyoming Rib and Chop House a few blocks away, says not necessarily. The restaurant is always busy in the summer, regardless of what customers are ordering.
Say they come in and they skip the appetizer, and then if they skip dessert, they're more apt to stay for a less amount of time than they would if they were to get all of the courses.
And why would that be a good thing in the summertime?
Then we could fill those seats again.
Shops and restaurants are hopeful that if a healthy flow of visitors passes through Cody this summer, they can avoid a drop-off in business. And if gas prices do jump, chances are better that tourism dollars will come from another source, visitors from within the region hoping to make the most of a vacation closer to home. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Martinez.
The Historic Territorial Prison in Laramie is opening a new exhibit this weekend, which focuses on the era after the facility was a prison, when the University of Wyoming used it for agriculture research. I spoke with Deborah A. Mend, the superintendent of the prison, before the opening, to hear about the history of the site and the important studies that were done there while it was used for ag. She says the prison was built 140 years ago as a federal territorial prison, but things changed in 1809 when Wyoming became a state.
The state of Wyoming legislature said to Laramie, you've got the university and you have the prison. You can only have one state facility. And so actually Rawlins was chosen to build the new penitentiary at that time. In 1903, the last prisoners move over to Rawlins, and the University of Wyoming College of Agriculture, moves on to this site. They wanted to create an experiment station. They were already in operation as an experiment station, but they needed a bigger facility, and this answered those needs. They were in existence on this site from 1903 until 1989. So 86 years, they operated, did experiments, students got their educations. In 1989, they acquired different property, moved off the site, and area local citizens from Laramie wanted to preserve the prison, this historic structure. And this group of individuals, along with the city, the county, and the state governments, got together and saved this historic site.
So now, while it was being used for ag, it had a lot of cutting-edge research really was going on there. Can you talk a little bit about that?
The cutting-edge research that was done here was pretty exciting at the time. Their focus was to try and improve the quality of life and the economic importance of farming and ranching for Wyoming citizens, like they did an incubation experiment here. The chickens at this very high altitude were having high mortality rates, and the chickens that were being born were inferior. And what they found out was they weren't getting enough oxygen at this level. So while the chickens are being incubated, they infused the incubators with oxygen. And the chickens grew healthier, bigger, and the mortality rate dropped severely. I mean, more of them survived because of that scientific research. And so that information was passed around to the other farmers and ranchers in the area. Another scientific research was a dietary research that they did on cattle. A lot of people refer to it as the hole in the cow. What they did was they basically surgically implanted a fistula, which was a round rubber plug, into the side of a living cow. And what they would do would they would take the plug out, reach their hand in with a big long rubber glove, and take feed samples out of their rumen, which is the largest part of the cow's stomach. And what they were looking for was digestibility of certain feeds, the role of bacteria played in digestion, how the absorption of the nutrients for the cow was being done. And so this was a living experiment that people actually, and it didn't hurt the cow, but people that will tell you that they, as a student that did that experiment, said it just, the smell was terrible. But it did give some great scientific results that was able to be given to the farmers and ranchers.
And part of this new exhibit touches on that. What will people be able to do?
Actually, people will be able to do the same thing. We have a mock-up of a mural of a cow, full-size cow, that we call it the Hole Story, H-O-L-E story, and they're going to be able to put their hand in the glove, reach inside, and feel the inside, the contents of the stomach. Now, we're not going to recreate everything, so you won't have the smell, and you won't have the cow kind of turning its head going, what are you doing back there? But it is going to give you that sense of, wow, this is what it feels like, the inside of a cow's rumen.
And obviously, while the prison was being used for ag, there was also a fair amount of animals being raised there, which I understand got shipped around the world.
Absolutely. There was a lot of different animals out here. The one that truly makes a large impact in the world is our sheep story. Sheep at this altitude was really kind of difficult to raise. And so this experiment station took it upon themselves to take a breeding program and increase the quality of the wool, increase the quality of the mutton and the animal itself, and really create an amazing husbandry program here for sheep. And what happened is it got recognition. These amazing sheep, these rams and these ewes, absolutely caught the attention worldwide. We sent and we partnered with countries such as Australia, New Zealand, Japan, China. We actually sent sheep to Central America and Afghanistan. We actually had the king of Afghanistan here on this site looking over this stock. And we have a photograph of him in our exhibit. And he is choosing his breeding stock to supplement his country's entire program. So what experiments were done here helped Wyoming's farmers and ranchers, but we impacted the world here.
All right. Well, Deborah, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That was Deborah Amend at the Territorial Prison in Laramie talking about their new exhibit, Science on the Range.
When we come back, we'll look at the job prospects for graduating college students, and we'll talk with Joan Evans from the Department of Workforce Services about job fairs they're holding around the state and what the job situation looks like. This is Open Spaces.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. Seniors at the University of Wyoming will be graduating next week. And while the job market is still tight around the country, prospects for finding employment have improved significantly this year. My colleague Willow Belden reports.
Hannah Hopp is an agroecology major at the University of Wyoming. Going through college during the recession, she wasn't sure what to expect from the job market. She pictured herself applying to dozens of places in hopes of getting a single offer. But the process was a lot easier than she anticipated. Hopp applied to just three jobs.
It was about a month or two until I heard back from two of them. Interviewed the same week for both of them, and then got a job up in Gillette.
A job in her field, doing what she wants to be doing.
I guess I really wanted into the horticulture side of things, and I got very lucky.
Lucky, perhaps, but Hopp is not alone. UW's Director of Career Services, Joe Kitka, says hiring is picking up this year.
You know, we saw it last spring that the number of companies coming to our career fairs and posting jobs with us was increasing. And this year, unfortunately, all the roads were closed in Laramie for our spring fair, but we would have had the largest number of companies attending. So it's definitely a better market than it has been the last couple of years.
Kitka says during the height of the recession, only about 40% of graduates found jobs, whereas this year, she expects that between 55 and 58% of students will find work within the next 6 months, which is comparable to pre-recession levels. Some colleges within the university are expecting even higher employment numbers.
Last year, for 2011, the College of Business had a 70% job offer rate. And I would expect the trend that we've seen from 2011 to continue into 2012.
That's Steve Farkas, who runs the Career Center for the College of Business. The College of Engineering is seeing a major uptick in hiring, too. Ryan Kobe heads career services there. He says 2 years ago, he was only able to pass about 30 job postings along to students. This year, there have been more than 50.
That's significant. We're starting to come close to our pre-2007 numbers. I think a lot of the companies are actually now hiring these positions that they left vacant in 2009 and 2010, and so we're seeing good growth.
Kobe says about 40% of engineering students have jobs lined up already, and 40% are planning on grad school, which only leaves a small percentage who have yet to find something to do. Predictably, a lot of the jobs are coming from the energy industry, and tech-related positions are also on the rise. It's not smooth sailing for everyone, though. Students with majors that don't have clear career paths tend to have a tougher time finding work. Emma Knox is one of those. She's an English major and wants to write for a living, ideally at a newspaper or magazine. But so far, she hasn't had any offers, so now she's applying to low-level jobs just to pay the rent.
Pretty much everything and anything, dishwashing jobs, gas station attendants, pretty much all just like entry-level. Almost no experience required.
Knox says she doesn't know of any fellow English majors who have jobs lined up in their field yet, and she says she'll probably have to go to a larger market to find the job she wants. Even in fields that are theoretically growing, some students are struggling. Education is a good example. Recent legislation requiring smaller class sizes in K through third grade means that elementary school positions are opening up. But that means some districts are cutting at the secondary level. So students like Matt Parrish are facing an uphill battle. Parrish wants to teach high school social studies, and he says there are only a handful of positions open in Wyoming.
Per one opening that opens up in the state, there's about 150 applicants who will apply for that job. So it's pretty competitive.
Competitive is a word that career services staff are tossing around a lot, even as they talk about improvements in the hiring market. Joe Kitka warns that while there are more jobs this year, there are also a lot of unemployed people seeking to fill those jobs.
So there are experienced people that have been looking for entry-level positions because they'd been laid off. But I think there's a bottleneck of people that maybe went on to graduate school because the market wasn't healthy at the point when they were graduating and are now graduating from graduate programs.
Kitka says many of those people are competing for the same jobs as college graduates. But she adds that if the economy doesn't get worse again, she expects the bottleneck to clear up within the next year or two, and she says that will be good for all job seekers. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Willow Belden.
The Wyoming Department of Workforce Services has been hosting a number of job fairs across the state, presumably because there are jobs to be had. Joan Evans is the department director. She says there are jobs for just about every type of worker, but it might require job training or relocation.
It really depends on what community in the state you live in as to where those opportunities are and how easily they are to access.
Are there some areas of the state where there are a lot of job openings, as an example?
Well, we do. It depends. For instance, we hear, you know, especially for youth, that some of the job markets are very tight. Our Sheridan office is saying that's a very tight market for youth. Other offices are saying, oh, you know, generally we have opportunities for them to come in. We're hosting a lot of career fairs, job fairs this time of year, specifically for our youth. For instance, Jackson High School is getting ready to do one in May. They'll reach about 600 kids doing that. So really, just trying to point people to our local workforce offices or our Wyoming at Work website, where they can kind of see regionally where those opportunities lie and where their skills match up.
Mm-hmm. What about people trying to locate to the state and trying to find jobs? I mean, what's out there?
Well, we do have a lot of job gains in natural resources and mining, including oil and gas. And the job losses in construction have slowed a bit. And, of course, this time of year, that always tends to ramp up. So those opportunities are out there. There are some construction projects going on, some larger projects, power plant, pipeline projects. So those provide opportunities. Again, I think we've seen a lot of people coming from out of state because our unemployment rate is, in the grand scheme of things, at the lower end. People will come here even without any kind of opportunity lined up, just saying, it's got to be better here than where I am. And so oftentimes they'll show up in a particular community and just say, kind of, you know, here I am, I'm ready to work. And they might not have any skills or anything that matches up with that sector of our state. So that doesn't always work out so well from the folks just coming here just to explore opportunities.
Let me ask you about a couple of other areas. One is veterans. I know you've been doing some job fairs with veterans. What's it look like? And let's first start with, what does the situation look like?
We really want to serve our veterans, and it's a priority for us on a state level as well as a national level through the Employment and Training Division through the U.S. Department of Labor. So based on that statement, we just got done hosting a tri-state job fair for veterans. It was the first time that we ever did that with Western Nebraska, Northern Colorado, and Cheyenne. And we were able to attract, oh my gosh, you know, just hundreds of people. I think over 200 participants in that. We had employers there, 49 employers with actual open positions. They were doing interviews, and we were able to connect folks with actual employment opportunities that day. So we do have folks in our local field offices that work specifically with our veterans, and we have a great partnership with the Veterans Service Commission, who handles the benefit side of questions for veterans. And we really want to be sure that they understand what's available for them, and that we have folks in our offices that specifically deal with them and kind of understand their needs a little bit more uniquely.
Last year, thanks to your office, we went out and talked to some people in Rawlins, and just as a snapshot of some folks who had lost their jobs and had been underemployed or unemployed for a long period of time. What are things looking like for those people?
We know that we have some folks that have been chronically unemployed, and we also have folks that are back into the labor market, but they aren't at anywhere near the earning level that they were maybe two and a half years ago. And the situation with those individuals, you know, they're not showing up in our number of unemployed individuals because they are probably working, but we know that their personal situations aren't near at the level that they were at the time that the economy really started to go down. So sometimes those folks kind of fall off the radar, so to speak. They've maybe been discouraged or thinking, well, I got this particular job, I guess I'll just stick with it. We'd still encourage them to, you know, come in. Again, we've got over 20 field offices around the state. You can go to our WyomingWorkforce.org site and find those specific locations. But if you feel like you haven't been able to, you know, get back to a level to where you were before the economy started to decline, please don't feel like you still can't come in and talk to us about that, and maybe some retraining or even just some help connecting with a different opportunity.
I know that was a tough conversation we had with a lot of those people that had been in a particular job for a long period of time, and they're in every day. And I sometimes wonder if people know that story out in the state, mm-hmm. that there are a lot of those folks out there.
Right. It kind of, if it's not a headliner on the front page, I think we start to think, oh, then everything's okay now. And for some folks, they have a whole different reality than they did a couple of years ago if they were in, you know, a high wage position and that job doesn't exist anymore and is not coming back, then what are the options for them? And we know we have folks in Wyoming working two, often three jobs. And so we need to, you know, remain diligent and provide as many resources as we can.
Well, the last group I want to talk to you about are University of Wyoming graduates who are coming out soon. What they say is they're hearing from more employers than maybe they have in the last couple of years. Is that a good sign?
That's a great sign. And we're working with some partners around the state, the university and the community colleges, and involving employers on STEM-related type jobs, the science, technology, engineering, and math opportunities. We really want to be able to be sure that we're communicating what employers have available specifically in those fields and others so that graduates will look at opportunities in Wyoming and not think, oh, there isn't anything here for me, and then go out of state. We've been trying to help specific employers attach to student groups at the university, make themselves visible, be sure that the students understand what the opportunities are, even when they're, you know, at the junior level, their senior year, so that they start to understand what may or may not be out there. But I think it's an encouraging sign, because the UW grads will always say, you know, I'm getting done, now what are my opportunities? And many of them do want to stay.
What's the position that you can't seem to find employees for people? I'm curious if there are jobs out there in the state that the employers are struggling to find the right employees.
Well, often technology jobs. I mean, that's one that we have heard about in the past. And as we hear about announcements of technology companies and the like showing interest in coming into our state, we want to be sure that we are fully ramped up and going to be able to provide them the personnel that they want. I think, again, Bob, it depends on where you live, but a particular area may be short of truck drivers. We may look at it and say, oh, we've probably saturated the market in training folks and getting them CDLs. But I heard from an individual with a company the other day saying, we can't even find CDLs. So again, being able to connect our field offices with businesses in those local communities and understand where the supply and demand is, and we can meet that local need.
Joan Evans is the director of the Department of Workforce Services. Always nice chatting with you. Thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
Wyoming has long been thought of as a state that focuses on energy, tourism, and in some cases, ranching, but the state has been trying to also make itself a player in technology. It started in earnest a few years back when the National Center for Atmospheric Research, or NCAR, was coming to Wyoming. The latest push has centered around data centers. Wyoming is offering sales tax incentives and grant money to try to attract them to the state. My colleague Bob Beck reports that many believe they could be an important piece in diversifying the economy.
Data that is not stored exclusively at the company is stored in something called a data center. That could include important records, human resources data, and even email. Some data centers store information for just one company, such as Microsoft, but others handle the data of a number of companies. Southern Wyoming in particular benefits from a lot of high-speed fiber optic capabilities, and Wyoming Business Council CEO Bob Jensen says that has allowed the state to be aggressive in trying to attract data centers.
It's a terrific diversification play for Wyoming. It's not susceptible to $2 natural gas. And so we just saw it as a natural industry to try and take advantage of the resource that was here and build a workforce around it.
In Jensen's view, data centers are the perfect Wyoming business.
They create high-wage jobs, highly technical jobs, but not a huge number of those jobs. And they also require pretty significant levels of capital investment, both initially and on an ongoing basis.
Which means they will create construction types of jobs as well. Recently, Microsoft made a splash by picking Cheyenne as the location for its next data center. Randy Bruins heads up the Cheyenne Economic Development Organization called Cheyenne Leads. He says this will be a major economic boost for Laramie County.
Their initial project here is going to be $112 million in hard assets. That's $112 million addition to our property base. And that's just the beginning. They are going to be paying taxes on a lot of electricity.
Brun says that ever since Microsoft said it was coming to Cheyenne, a number of other major companies have contacted the state and have indicated they'd also like to consider Wyoming. But state economic development officials say smaller data centers are just as important. At the edge of Cheyenne, Greenhouse Data is an example. Sean Mills is the president.
We're housing your data that you own in our equipment or in your equipment. So whether it's email data, whether it's videos, whether it's stock imagery, whether you are a company that's offering software services, you could place all of that data here and feel comfortable that it is secure and has incredible amount of broadband connectivity out to the world so that your customers could access that, or you could access that for that matter.
It's a 10,000 square foot facility that uses renewable wind power to reduce its costs. As Mills shows us around, he explains that the facility is highly secure and includes computers that can provide advanced warnings for fires and things that can withstand a disaster. The front even features bulletproof glass. The data computers themselves are in rows and are enclosed in very cool rooms. Mills won't say what the company takes in, but he says they do very well financially and have plans to expand. They also have similar facilities in Denver and in Portland. Mills quickly points out that by being in Wyoming, they also are a big boost to their customers.
You know, we actually can say we've saved companies in Wyoming a lot of money. You know, a lot of companies in Laramie have chosen to get their data center services from companies in Denver. Because we built our facility here, we're able to leverage some of the proximity to lower that bandwidth costs. I mean, and literally by a factor of 40 to 70%.
Another data center that serves businesses in Wyoming is Ptolemy Data Systems in Sheridan. CEO Ryan Mulholland offers both a data center as well as data consulting services.
You know, a lot of the larger data centers believe that the best way to run a data center is to never have contact with your customers. In fact, they feel like it costs them money to have contact with their customers. We're the opposite.
He believes having such a facility in Sheridan will actually lead to business creation because those companies know their data needs can be taken care of locally. Because of Wyoming's low electricity costs and cool climate, he expects the data center industry will explode. And that's the point of State Senator John Schiffer of KC. The Republican opposed Governor Meade setting aside $10 million to try to attract data centers from other places. And he doesn't think the state should provide tax breaks to companies from other places because the focus should be on local companies. Schiffer would like the state to grow its own. But Cheyenne leads Randy Bruin says that the bigger data centers bring a lot of money to the state. Now, Wyoming couldn't attract them without state incentives, something Microsoft made very clear.
They told us right up front, we would not be having this conversation with any of you in Wyoming were it not for those incentives that the legislature put in place over a couple years.
Bruin says the best idea is for Wyoming to have a mix of large and small data centers. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
When we come back, Clay Scott from the University of Montana brings us his segment called Mountain West Voices. This is Open Spaces.
This is Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. Clay Scott from the University of Montana rejoins the program now with his occasional segment called Mountain West Voices.
When I was in junior high school, I signed up for the orchestra. I remember the director as a self-important, insecure, and bitter man who used ridicule as a teaching tool. I left after the first practice and never went back. The other day when I was in Sheridan, Wyoming, I couldn't help wondering how my school experience might have been different if I'd had a teacher like Razmik Sarkisian, the orchestra director at Sheridan High School.
Let's go. Andante con moto. Associate yourself with some idea that this music will make sense, all right? All right. Thank you. We live through association. We learn through association. Let's go. Profit from the bottom of your heart and...
Thank you.
Razmik Sarkisian, or Mr. S, as his students call him, didn't start out to be a music teacher or a conductor. When he was a kid in Armenia, and later in Iran, and after that at an Armenian boarding school in Calcutta, India, he took for granted that he would become an engineer or a scientist of some sort.
In my culture, education is put on a pedestal and literally worshipped, and there are not many opportunities for students to go to college. So I come here and all these opportunities, all these facilities kind of interested me.
When Razmik came to the U.S., he did study science as he'd planned, but he never stopped playing the violin, and he ended up with a second degree in music education from the University of Wyoming. That came in handy because his wife had just had a baby and he needed a job. He was hired to teach at the junior high and high schools in Sheridan, Wyoming. That was 32 years ago, and the job turned out to be a pretty good fit for him.
All the great leaders in this world, from the pharaohs down, kept building. They went to culture. Bigger, more sophisticated. All right?
All right, let's go. Rick.
May the orchestra gods be on the seconds and violas in the middle section. One, two, here it is. One, two, three, bang.
Nearly all the players in this orchestra have been studying with Mr. S from the time they were in elementary school. One of them is violinist Emma Hall, a senior who's about to go off to Brown University.
I mean, he's an orchestra teacher, so he teaches music, obviously, but he teaches almost even more so about life. I love him as much as it's possible for a student to love a teacher. He's more like an uncle to me than anything. I've known him almost my entire life, and he's played a huge instrumental role, no pun intended, in my life.
Ready? Play it now. Ready? One, and two, and three, and four, and... No, G-sharp against it. G-sharp against it. Malik, mind your manners. G-sharp, 49, yeah. Ready? 3 and 4 and... There are kids, they come here with many problems. I need to be sensitive to their emotional needs, you know, and they need to understand that it's okay to not be able to perform, but they also are aware that learning is a procedure, it's a painstaking labor of love, and we will get there. They're all committed, and I love them for that. Through hard work, you can be very successful. You can experience joy in learning, and that is the focus of my effort every day, to experience joy in learning. And that joy will come when one has experienced truth in learning.
You've been listening to Mountain West Voices. Our series is produced in association with the O'Connor Center for the Rocky Mountain West, a regional studies and public education program of the University of Montana. Support for today's program was provided by the Foundation for Community Vitality. To see images from today's story and to listen to and download dozens of archived stories from around the Rocky Mountain West, go to mountainwestvoices.org. I'm Clay Scott.
A That's our program for this week. If you want to hear it again, you can find it online at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Tara Orr is our web editor. You can also send us ideas for future programs on that site and sign up for our podcast. For those of you on Facebook, we invite you to become a fan of Wyoming Public Radio News by clicking on the like button. And for news updates and less important information, you may follow us on Twitter under the names Butter Bob, T. Otto, Martinez, R.L., and Willow Belden. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.